Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin. As many of you know, in addition to my work as a chiropractor, I am a doula. And my wife, who is a perinatal psychologist, is also a doula. We had our first three babies at the hospital and our fourth at home. We have both attended births of clients in the hospital and out of hospital, and there are some characteristic differences between hospital and out of hospital birth. Today, we're going to discuss some of the history and evolution of modern childbirth, as well as practical differences and considerations when it comes to choosing your birth setting and your birth provider. My guests today are Dr. Emiliano Shavira, who is a unique OBGYN and perinatologist. Unique in many ways, but one of which is his close collaboration with midwives and his support of clients who choose to birth out of the hospital and back them up should they need to transfer care during pregnancy or birth. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. You forgot to mention that I drive a Batmobile.
You have a Batmobile on a cape.
It's parked outside.
I can't wait to go play with it. I hope I get a test drive.
I want to see that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Also in the studio is a proud mother of two, delicately balancing her motherhood and her artistic work as an actress, dancer, writer, and producer. She's an advocate for empowering and uplifting women, especially young women. She had her first baby in a hospital with an obstetrician and her second baby just 3 weeks ago out of the hospital with midwives. Janice Sardoit, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for being here and leaving your cave to
yes,
share your experience with
my
us.
Nest.
Your nest. I'll admit that I use the word traditional birth in the opening, and it's a confusing term. To some people in developed countries in particular, traditional birth refers to the most common type of birth today, which is hospital birth. But to other people, traditional birth means what it was before modernized birth, which was home birth. I saw in an article from the BBC, there was a historian, Margaret Marsh from Rutgers University, who gave this basic timeline that up until about 1760, women gave birth at home, largely supported by her female relatives, friends, and also the help of a midwife. Around 1760, upper-class women wanted doctors at their births, believing that their advanced education would lead to safer births. Doctor-assisted home births became very popular, and by 1900, about half of all births were attended by midwives, and by 1935, only 15% by midwives. Over time, rivalry developed between doctors and midwives. Doctors would say, "We know more about anatomy, so we're better suited to do this." And midwives would say, "We're women, and we do this. We have experience with this. We know how to do this better." For many decades, the tug of war broke down along gender lines. All of the doctors were male and all of the midwives were female. The shift to hospital births started in the 1930s when anesthesia was advancing for delivering children and women were sold on the concept of pain-free childbirth. At first, there were lots of complications in hospital birth with anesthesia. By the 1960s, doctors were delivering nearly all the babies and at hospitals, and midwifery seemed to be on the road to extinction until the feminist movement of the 1970s revived women's interest in midwives. Women once again wanted to control their own childbirth experience. Here we are now, and out-of-hospital birth is on the rise today. What was once thought of as only being for fringe, tree-hugging, Prius-driving, vegan hippies, like me, is now a choice made by very diverse women and partners from all backgrounds, ethnicities, socioeconomic classes, professions, religions, etc. We have an episode, in fact, with Dr. Jennifer Lang, an OBGYN, who originally thought she wanted to have an elective cesarean and then ended up choosing unmedicated hospital birth for her first baby and home birth with midwives for the next two. Several documentaries make the case for home birth, including The Iconic Business of Being Born with Ricky Lake and Abby Epstein. And we have an episode with Ricky talking about the film and what her inspirations were to make the film and some of its impact over the past 10 years. Other films like Why Not Home share the stories of doctors, nurses, and midwives who choose to have their babies at home. Of course, today, at least in Los Angeles, now you have interesting options like midwives attending hospital birth and obstetricians attending home birth. And of course, there are many more female obstetricians and a handful of male midwives, and at least one male doula that I know of. Janice, let's start with you. You had your first baby at a hospital.
I did.
What was your planning and thinking as you got ready to have your first baby? Was it ever a question?
So it was definitely a question. My norm with my family is obviously you have an obstetrician, you have your birth in the hospital, your baby in the hospital, I should say. And something didn't feel right. I don't know where that came from. And I just started doing a little bit of research. And I noticed that in Los Angeles, I'm originally from Miami, Florida. So it's midwives is not a thing out there at all. But I'm in Los Angeles, and I started doing research, and I noticed there was some midwifery. There was a location in Culver City called The Sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there, and I checked it out, and it was amazing. All the midwives were amazing. It just felt right. And so it was really hard to get my husband on board because he also comes from that mindset of, what are you talking about? You have a doctor, and then you have a baby in the hospital.
For you guys, is that your mindset in general, that place your trust in medicine versus more holistic things? Or just in terms of birth, it's a foreign concept?
I think in terms of birth, it was a foreign concept because of our family. But I'm more on the holistic side of things with my general health.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I had to question that when I became pregnant.
It wasn't until you were pregnant that you started thinking about it.
Right. I never thought of it before because, I don't know, I guess I wasn't pregnant. I wasn't, you know, so you don't really think about those things until you're in it.
I think
and
that's pretty common,
it.
Though.
What's that?
To not really think about the choices until you get there.
Right, exactly. So once I was there, there was something deep inside of me that said, no, I don't want to be in a hospital. But I had to do the research because no one in my family, not even my closest friends, knew where I could look or what to do or where to go. They're like, what are you talking about? What are you going to do? And they started calling me, you know, oh, what are you, a hippie? Are you crazy? And I just said, you know what? It's okay, guys. I don't need your support. I had to make my husband watch Ricky Lake's Business of Being Born for him to get on board. He was so against it at first. He saw the Business of Being Born. He was like, I don't want you near hospital ever.
Okay, so he did a total 180.
But yes, thank God.
What was his opposition? What was he, when he made the argument, no way we're having a baby outside the hospital, the first stance,
mm-hmm.
what was that based on? Just because it's not done? Was he afraid of certain things?
I think the fear of the unknown, like he was like, where else are you going to have a baby? And, you know, what is the other option? And just the fear of the unknown. And so once I showed him the Business of Being Born and I found the Sanctuary and I told him, come with me, let's check it out together. Let's see what this is about. He definitely switched. It wasn't even a hard switch. He was like, wow, this makes a lot of sense.
But you still had your baby in a hospital.
I ended up being a transfer, yes.
Oh, you weren't planning to have your baby in the hospital?
No.
Ah, mm-mm. So we're going to have to find out more about that.
Yeah.
You were planning to have the baby with midwives
mm-hmm.
at home or at the birth center?
No, at the birth center.
Why did you choose birth center instead of home?
It was my first, and I think home was a little bit too, I don't know if the right word is foreign, and I didn't want my family was already very stressed out that I was choosing a different route.
So to them, did birth center feel like an in-between? Not at home, but not at the hospital?
They never said that, but I think I made that decision for them. I was like, I think they're going to feel
a little more comfortable.
A little more comfortable and maybe that I'm safer, I don't know, than at being at home.
Why, do they have a fire extinguisher? because I think a lot of people don't realize that a birth center is oftentimes just an apartment or
exactly,
a loft somewhere.
Which is what it was, funny enough, right. Then with the sanctuary. I'm not sure. I just kind of made that decision
for them.
I didn't really give them – I mean, at the end of the day, it's my child, my birth, my experience, so no one really had a say.
But for you, was there a benefit to birth center over home besides how it would be perceived by other people?
Well, at the time, we also were living in a two-story townhouse.
Okay.
Felt a little, I don't know, I didn't want to do it at home. It was carpet.
I hear that also a lot, but isn't the birth center just a one studio?
Well, at that time, the sanctuary had a one-bedroom, big old, beautiful.
That was bigger than your two-story
It wasn't necessarily bigger, but it just felt more comfortable. It felt like it was prepared for that. They also had the tub, which I didn't have at my home.
It was a very nice tub.
It was super beautiful. You felt like you were at a spa. It just felt better than my home.
So
at the
benefit for you too. You wanted to be there, and it was aesthetically very pleasing to you.
Yes,
it was a really beautiful center.
It was.
We say past tense because it closed down.
Correct.
All right, and then you did your care with those midwives, and then what happened for labor?
So I was a 4-day labor.
Okay. You really like to get your money's worth because it's a flat fee. So
it was intense.
It was pretty smart.
And I did have a backup, and it was at the Good Samaritan downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up there. The midwife said out of exhaustion, and I was kind of.
How did labor start, that one?
That one started on a Tuesday. I'll never forget. I went to go pee. I lost my mucus plug, and boom, contractions started.
Oh, really? That
quick? Yeah, it was pretty, like, back-to-back.
Where were you in relation to your due date?
I was actually 4 days late. I was due on the 24th.
4 days past your due date anyway.
Well, I started on the 24th, but she came on the 28th.
Right.
So.
So it started right away with contractions, and then it just went on for four days without a lot of progress?
It was very kind of up and down the first few days, and then it was very consistent, but I was just not, I guess, I got myself all the way to 8.5 centimeters, so.
Oh, that's pretty far.
Yeah, but I got stuck at some point there, and they were getting worried because I was literally falling asleep in between contractions.
Hmm.
Like, I would have the contraction, and I would just, like, knock out.
So you were at the birth center?
Yes.
In the beautiful tub, or they did not let you get in there?
I was in there, but then I got
in and out. Okay.
Kind of feeling it out.
So they made the choice with you.
Yes.
That you should transfer to a hospital.
Yes.
And what happened at the hospital?
Thankfully, the Good Samaritan had, at that time, they had nurse midwives there. So when I got there, they already knew who I was, and it was really quick and easy, and they said I should get an epidural, which I really didn't want. But everybody, even my midwives, the nurse midwives there, were like, yes, we think you should get this. And so I finally gave in.
Was there a reason you didn't want it?
I just really wanted to do it on my own. I didn't want any interventions. I didn't want to have any.
Are you like that in general?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
We have nothing in common. I like a lot of help.
Oh, no. I was like, I can do this, right? But I was very tired, and my body was stuck, and it was a long, long labor. So I finally gave in. And I'll never forget, my first experience with the doctor that gave me the epidural was very condescending. And he said to me, so you couldn't hack it on your own, right? I'm like, who says that to a woman in labor?
Jeez.
About to get an epidural. It was traumatic. And my husband was holding my hand. And I guess gave him a really nasty look because after that he didn't say anything else. Gave me the epidural and things went really quickly after that. I lost feeling in my legs at that point. So.
But you went from 8.5 to 10 quickly? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And then I pushed, I think, for maybe 20 minutes.
You couldn't do it in 10, huh?
No, you don't.
I know I don't. I mean, you're tough, by the way. If I met you in a dark alley and you were mad, I would run. Wouldn't fight.
Yeah, you should.
Okay. So that was your first birth experience.
That was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Shavir, I mean, most obstetricians deliver in hospitals. There's a handful who also do home birth. In this town, there's a few who also do home birth. In terms of practicality, I mean, we talked about the history a little bit. I mean, everybody used to give birth at home. Not to say that it was, you know, we had the greatest outcomes ever. But then for various reasons, I think anesthesia was the big one that pulled people into a hospital. Are there benefits in your mind to delivering at home versus delivering in a hospital and vice versa?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, very, very often this, the conversation is trying to figure out which one's better, which one's superior. And they're really just very different. And, you know, there are certainly going to be births that are not appropriate to happen at home. But if we're just talking about, you know, normal pregnancies, normal births, there's just a different set of, you know, risks and benefits to being in the hospital versus giving birth at home. So the thing that people really worry about is that some natural disaster is going to occur during the labor and, you know, lightning's going to strike or somebody's head is going to explode or, I'm kind of being flippant, but, you know, there's a lot of concern about some acute, horrific complication that's going to happen in the middle of labor. And if you're in the hospital, then there are certain capabilities that we have, for example, an OR and, you know, blood transfusions and anesthesia and other specialists and so forth. And if the baby's not doing well, we have the pediatricians and the NICU and the neonatologists. So if you are one of those, you know, unlucky people that suffers a real severe complication that you really need to respond to within seconds or minutes, yeah, that you're better off if that happens to you in the hospital. But the thing is, the likelihood that you're going to have that is pretty low. So what is the price that you pay for being in the hospital? You know, first of all, you have to get up and leave wherever you started labor and transport yourself to the hospital. I've never done it, but labor seems to be a pretty intense physical endeavor from what I've seen. And it's interesting, you know, we normalize the notion that, you know, you're in labor and then you jump in a car and you get on a freeway and you drive over to the hospital because that's what everybody does. Mm-hmm. So we don't think about that as a thing, but that's a thing.
You talked about the unlikely possibility of severe time crunching emergency happening. Mm-hmm. When those do happen, are they more likely to happen during labor or at the very end? Could they happen in the middle of labor, or are they, when they do happen, usually at the very end?
They could happen in the middle of labor. So I'm thinking of examples of things like what we used to call amniotic fluid embolism, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden the mom is having respiratory collapse and she can't breathe. And you get a clotting disorder that comes with that, so she starts hemorrhaging. It's an extremely life-threatening complication. And so if I'm going to have an amniotic fluid embolism, I plan to have that in hospital, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it's an incredibly rare complication that you can go through your whole career as an obstetrician and never see one.
But I see so many people who feel the safety net of the hospital for pushing. So they want to labor at home as long as possible and then transfer to the hospital towards the very end for pushing. But you're saying this can happen during any point of labor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the odds are very small to begin with, but if they're going to happen, laboring at home doesn't necessarily protect you from that.
Right.
What are some of the other things?
Another example would be a condition like abruption, the placenta separates itself prematurely from the uterine wall. And now, of course, that's a spectrum condition, right? You can have a separation that's so minor that nobody ever knows it happened. Mm-hmm. The other end of the spectrum is where a very large portion of the placenta, or maybe even the majority of it, separates from the uterine wall. And that's becomes acutely life-threatening for both mom and baby.
Is that, again, something that can happen during the middle of labor?
It can. But it's also incredibly rare, you know, for that to happen.
How do you know it happened?
The common symptoms are, one is intense pain. Mm-hmm. So out of proportion to what you normally experience in labor.
You might also have
pain.
But will you feel it if you're totally numbed from epidural?
Actually, you still might.
You still might.
and you there also may be pain in between contractions,
mm-hmm.
which there, you know, usually the pain is in the contraction and the contraction relaxes. You have a few seconds or a couple minutes of reprieve until the next, you know, contraction comes. But with, if you're having a really bad abruption, there might be pain just continuously.
Mm. Just to the way people are monitored at the hospital versus monitored at home, I'm generalizing, but oftentimes in the hospital, you're monitored remotely by machines, and nurses come and go, doctors less commonly come and go. But at home, you're usually surrounded by a midwife who's around you, or at a birthing center, looking at you, talking to you, touching you, who's gotten to know you very well. It almost seems possible that would one of those complications comes up, they might detect it quicker at home, where you're not medicated and more aware of what you're feeling.
Well, theoretically, that might be possible, but the response time when you're in the hospital is going to be much quicker.
Sure. But some of the birthing centers are right next to a hospital. So, I mean, you could end up in a situation where you become aware of it minutes earlier and or more and right. and then get to the hospital and take action quicker. Also, something that occurs to me because I lived in Nebraska for a little while is that not every hospital has an anesthesiologist and a surgeon ready to go
right.
when one of these things pops up. So
that's right.
hospitals that do a few hundred births a year may not be able to jump into action that quickly. In those cases, I'm not sure how giving birth next to the hospital is all that different from giving birth at the hospital.
Yeah, and that's why if you look at data comparing safety of home birth to hospital birth, it's an error to be overly simplistic about that. And I mean, this is the way it is interpreting all research. You have to be very thoughtful about, well, exactly what circumstance are we talking about? Because you've highlighted some things that would change significantly the safety of a home birth, right? If you're right next door to a hospital, that's very different from if you're doing a home birth and you're an hour outside the city.
Sure.
That transport's going to take you an hour to get into a city. Those are very different circumstances.
Right. And so I didn't mean to cut you off. You had the amniotic embolism.
Right.
The placental detachment,
mm-hmm.
partial or complete. What are some of the other things that can come up?
You can have cord prolapse where the umbilical cord slips past the baby and comes out the vagina.
Is that rare with a head-down baby?
It's pretty rare. It's definitely way less than 1%.
Is it always a major complication?
It is not always. You know, every case is an individual case, but if you're talking about a head-down birth, the head generally fills the birth canal.
Mm-hmm.
So if the umbilical cord somehow gets past the head, it's very likely that head is going to be squishing the umbilical cord against the walls of the birth canal.
So compressing the cord.
So compressing the cord and
that's the baby's only source.
Yeah, cutting off oxygen supply to the baby. And there does appear to be a correlation between, you know, the longer that condition persists, the more likely that is to hurt the baby.
Sure.
So it's a condition you usually want to respond to, you know, very quickly.
What would you do for it in a hospital?
The simple answer that usually is going to be an emergency C-section.
So you can't maneuver things so that you take pressure off the cord, or that
there are case reports like that. There are case reports of reducing the umbilical cord back into the uterus, but in most cases, what's going to end up happening is an emergency C-section.
Mm-hmm. What else you got?
I think the main. It's kind of stepping back a little bit and getting back to your original question, you know, like the pros and cons of being in the hospital and at home. We've sort of given a couple of examples of conditions that could potentially happen that if you are in the hospital, they can respond to those quicker and they have more capabilities. So I think that's what you gain by being in the hospital is the ability to respond to these types of emergencies. But you lose something as well. Mm-hmm. And so you lose, you know, being in the comfort of your own home. There may be restrictions on who can be present at your birth. It's a very common question. How many people can I bring into the labor room? And I always say no more than 25. That's an absolute limit. But, you know, there can be restrictions on who's present at your birth. And then if you end up with a C-section, usually one person is allowed to go in to the birth with you.
But you wouldn't do a C-section at home, probably.
Well, that's true. Also, the experience of labor is very different because there are so many protocols in the hospital. There are certain things like they're usually going to have you on an empty stomach. They're going to place an IV into your hand, which is, you know, can be painful / uncomfortable.
Mm. I think in addition to painful and uncomfortable, it's not all that empowering, meaning it doesn't make you feel very safe and like everything. Like your nervous system responds to the stimuli around you. So when we shove this emergency shunt in your vein and say, we think you're probably going to die, but we'll at least have this emergency shunt in there. It doesn't.
That may depend on the person.
I'm giving you feedback from patients, you know, who putting on a hospital gown doesn't make you feel very strong, healthy, vibrant, like I'm expressing my healthiest moment here.
Absolutely. Now, if you're doing a home birth, I guarantee you, you're being taken care of by somebody who knows you and knows you very well. Mm-hmm. A very common element of hospital births is that you're cared for by strangers.
Right.
It may, in fact, be that you're taken care of by whoever was doing your prenatal care, and you know that certainly happens. But it's a very common practice for women to get prenatal care in some kind of clinic or office, and the person who's on duty on the day of the birth is somebody they're meeting for the first time. So you're attended to by strangers.
And sometimes multiple people, like in the case of a four-day birth, you probably have many nurses and doctors coming in.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And a couple
people
of people
I have never met or seen before, so.
One or two people just to count how many gloves are in stock. Mm. Okay, this is fascinating. Let's take a quick break and come right back to continue the conversation.
I understand the mental demands of motherhood. I see it every day in my practice. That's why I'm excited about Needed's new cognitive support. Unlike other supplements, it's specifically formulated with postpartum and breastfeeding moms in mind, using safe and effective ingredients. This means that moms can get the brain boost they deserve without compromising safety. Plus, it includes clinically studied ingredients, proven to support focus and memory. Hurry and get your cognitive support from Needed before you forget. Visit thisisneeded.com and use your code Berlin to get 20% off your initial order. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.
Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, here discussing birth settings and providers with our guests, Janice Sardoui and Dr. Emiliano Shavira. Janice, your first birth was a whirlwind. Just 3 weeks ago, you had your second baby.
Yes.
And you went back to a birthing center.
I did. Different one, but
a different one. Center. Did you? I mean, after your first experience, did you think maybe I should just do this at a hospital?
Not at all.
No.
No, I personally was not happy in the hospital from the first moment of getting the epidural from a doctor that told me, "Oh, did I give up or I couldn't hack it?" It was just really here I am. It just didn't feel right. So when I got pregnant the second time, I looked at my husband and was like, we got to find a birthing center because the sanctuary had closed.
Right.
So I did. I found Del Mar Birthing Center in South Pasadena, and they are amazing. And because I was a hospital transfer the first time, I did have that fear in the back of my mind, like, is that going to happen again? So I was definitely comforted when I was told Huntington Hospital was 5 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to know that, because I believe that is there for emergencies, you know, hospitals.
Yeah.
For when you're in labor, an emergency, like we just talked about, comes up. That's what the hospitals are there for. That's what those doctors are there for. And that is my belief. I know I have friends that they're like, nope, I feel safer in the hospital and I want to be in that setting. And to each his own. For me, I think it's empowering to just feel safe in that moment. For me personally, I feel safer with midwives and the people that I invite to be in that moment. But every woman's different, so.
How did your second labor start?
At home, at 1 a.m, woke me up in bed, and my husband was right next to me. I was like, okay, cool, this is happening. And it was very calming, I guess, because I already did it. And I knew what to expect in a sense. I mean, every time is definitely unique and different. But I did it once, and I'm alive, and my child's healthy and happy. So I was like, I can do this. So it was fine. And I did most of my labor at home. I had the same doula. She's amazing. She came around 8, 9 in the morning and just started assisting me, helping me. And my husband had to go to work, so he's like, I'll be right back, I promise. I was like, you can't promise that. What if I have this baby and you're not here? But he did come back, and we did a little bit more. Around 5 p.m., we ended up going to the center, to the Del Mar Birthing Center, which is only 15 minutes away from where I live, thank God. And
What made you go at that point?
My doula. She was pretty much kind of like the coach there. She was definitely leading the pack.
Because if you go too early, they'll send you back home.
Yes, and I was not. No, that's so uncomfortable. I mean, it didn't happen to me, but I've heard it happen. So she knew. You know, she's an amazing doula. She has experience. She's been doing it for a while. So, and she also knows me. She was with me my first. So she's like, okay, we're ready. Let's do this. And she called my midwives and let them know we're on our way. And at 1 a.m, so it was a 24-hour labor. He was there. And so I did most of the day
quick.
At home. Yeah, compared to the 4-day, right? So most of it at home, and then the nighttime with the midwives at the center, and he came at 1 a.m, so it was
did
about a 24-hour.
Did they check your cervix when you got there?
They did, and I believe I was really in and out at that point. Mm-hmm. I think they said, I don't remember. I think I was at like 5 or 6. I can't remember.
Did labor get intense for you? You're so calm about it. I just wondered, you know, did you struggle with it at all?
I did. I actually had a moment where I was like, I can't do this. I said it out loud. And my midwives, my doula, my mother, and my best friends that were in the room, and my husband, they were like, yes, you can. But with such confidence. And that's why I chose those people to be there. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. I can do this. And so I did. But I did have that moment. And I did do the nitrous.
It's good to have in case you need dental work in the middle of, you know, 7 centimeters.
What happened right after that moment when you said you couldn't anymore? Then what came next? I'm curious.
Actually, I was pushing. It was that, and it's funny, my midwives, because the first time since I had the epidural, I didn't feel much of anything around that time during pushing and things like that. I mean, I could push, and I did have a vaginal birth, but I didn't feel anything, and my midwives knew that, so they said, okay, you're going to feel the ring of fire, and I was like, what? What are you talking about, the ring of fire? And I did. I felt just that. I felt like a fire, but it wasn't anything I couldn't do or was going to die. It just felt that way. And I was like, oh, wow, that's what they're talking about. That makes sense. I didn't feel that the first time because I was, you know, drugged up. So
So you were happier feeling the Ring of Fire?
I personally was. Yeah. I thought it was so cool. Like, oh, okay, they said I was going to feel this. This is what I'm feeling. This is what it feels like. And it's that moment where, okay, I'm about to meet my baby. So for me, it was very exciting, but I'm a very hippie gypsy girl. So
because you can feel more, did it feel more like an active participation on your part?
That, and it also felt like I'm in charge of me and my body, and I'm very in tune and aware. I know what's going on. I felt very disempowered with the epidural. I didn't know what was going on. I was being told when to push, when not to push. I couldn't feel much of anything. So for me, that felt, it just didn't feel good for me.
At the birth center, was there no coaching on your pushing? You just push when you felt like
there
it?
There was definitely coaching, but it was kind of like this, we were all one in a sense, because what they were telling me made sense to me.
You can feel it.
I can feel it, yes. And funny enough, I have a little theory. This is my personal theory. I didn't tear at all with this birth, and with my first I did. And I personally believe that when you can't feel down there and you're pushing so hard, even though they're telling you when to push and when not to push, you're just like going all crazy. I feel like, yes, you're more likely to tear because you have no feeling and sensation or kind of control, versus when I had no drugs, no epidural, I knew exactly what was going on down there. I knew my body. I knew when to stop. Even though I was being coached, I also was making the decision, you know, when to back off, when to not at that same time. So it's my theory. I could be completely wrong, and it's very you know, out there, but I think that you're less likely to tear.
Is there data on that you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one thing that makes it a little bit complicated is, in general, you see a lot less tears on the second pregnancy than the first. Mm. So there's that. But on the other hand, if you look at the American College of OBGYN committee opinion on home birth versus hospital, they have a table that goes through some of the statistics about different complications of pregnancy and the incidence, you know, home versus hospital. And so one of the things that's very clear is the incidence of significant perineal tears is lower in home births.
Interesting.
And then I think just on a conceptual...
What about in the hospital, medicated versus unmedicated?
I don't know if I've seen that.
Curious.
That would be interesting.
But yeah, I mean, there may be something on that out there that I'm just, you know, not familiar with. But I think the concept that you're talking about is, you know, I've come to appreciate in the last several years where I've had a lot more interaction with midwives and conversations with them, the notion that mom can feel baby passing through the birth canal and she responds to what she's feeling intuitively in order to assist, you know, the baby to pass through the birth canal, and mom and baby are kind of doing this dance together. Right. That's just very old midwife knowledge. Mm-hmm. That for us OBs, it's totally foreign because we don't talk about that. Right. During our training, and it's just kind of a thing that we're not really attuned
to. Like an old wives' tale.
Yeah, but I think there probably really is something to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. For sure.
You mentioned, Dr. Shabir, at the beginning that there are certain births that would not be appropriate in your mind to have outside of a hospital. What are some of those?
Well, it probably depends on who you ask. There are midwife organizations that actually have, you know, published criteria, and I'm not totally familiar with those since that's not my practice. I'm not a midwife. But there's certain things like you're not going to have a preemie baby at home. And so probably you're limiting to something like 36, 37 weeks or beyond. Conditions where there are significant birth defects in the baby and you're expecting the baby's going to need some kind of specific care at the time of birth. So we're talking about, you know, well-formed, you know, normal, full-term baby. Usually the mom does not have significant medical complications like, you know, really severe diabetes. A lot of times, milder forms of gestational diabetes, there's kind of a fudge factor there. Mm-hmm. She's not going to have, you know, real bad hypertension, cardiac disease, heart disease, kidney disease. She's sort of basically a healthy mom, a full-term, you know, normal baby, which is the majority of pregnancies, right?
Are the healthy,
yeah. You know, so... In the end, probably most women would be candidates for home birth, but I think if we ever have a conversation with this about a midwife, they could be a lot more specific.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I was just curious in your mind if there are certain things that you would rather see at a hospital. What are some of the reasons that people – Janice transferred because it sounds like mostly exhaustion. With your first pregnancy, what are some of the reasons that people transfer care? Because they transfer sometimes to you, right? A person will be laboring at home with their midwife, and they come into you. What are some of the reasons that would happen?
So that's a real common one.
Exhaustion.
For whatever reason, the labor's on a very slow trajectory. Mom's just getting really pooped out. Usually she's days into it. Most of the time... Mom is, you know, there's this sort of the OB's nightmare of, you know, everything is going to heck and
train wreck.
And but most of the time, mom is in perfectly good condition. Baby's in perfectly good condition. They're just tired. Very often we will do an epidural and get mom some rest.
Can you turn that down later if she wants to feel pushing?
You can. Some moms are interested in doing that. Some moms are, you know, have become very worn down and the degree of pain has become something overwhelming for them and they don't want it to come back. So that's kind of an individualized thing. I have had patients be transferred to me because they're starting to have high blood pressure, and so they see that. I've had cases where there was some concern about the fetal heart rate, and the baby get, you know, so they transfer into the hospital. But usually the circumstances are very, very stable. It's not actually an emergency that brings them in. It's, you know, there's some feature going on, and the mom and her midwife have a conversation about it, and they decide mutually that they want to move over to the hospital and they do so. Vast majority of the time, we end up with a vaginal birth.
Are there things that would cause a transfer after the birth?
Yeah.
That can't be handled at home?
Sure. There could be maybe a significant tear that's going to be very painful or very difficult to repair at home. So sometimes moms will come in for a repair of a vaginal tear. There could be issues with bleeding, where maybe the feeling is mom might need a blood transfusion or be evaluated for a blood transfusion, so she may come in for that. There could be a transfer because maybe the baby is looking like the baby needs some help after birth, maybe struggling to breathe or some other issues, and they want to bring the baby in for evaluation or support. So there could be a whole host of reasons to transfer after the birth.
I remember when we had our home birth, the midwives, one thing that was surprising to me was how many duffel bags of stuff the midwives brought in. It almost felt like an episode of MASH. There was just more and more and more. And they all laid it out very neatly and it was ready. They ended up like not using anything except gauze pads, really. But they seemed to be prepared to deal with a lot of urgency at home should it arise.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And to stabilize things before transferring in those situations. Out of all the home births I've attended, I can only think of one actual emergency that we transported to the hospital for very quickly. Everything else, every other transport was, as you said, mom's exhausted, not really progressing that well. She wants an epidural at that point. The pain is overtaking her, becoming more of a suffering than a pain, things like that.
Yeah.
Have you attended home birth ever?
I have not attended home births. I've witnessed some home births that were being attended by
not attended as a physician, but you've been in a birth at home,
right?
As an observer,
right?
Is it something that, I mean, obstetricians, medical doctors can, within their scope of practice, practice at home, although the ACOG seems to come out against it as often as possible, not even for doctors attending home birth, but for people even having home birth. Does this still tap into that early 1900 tug-of-war between midwives and obstetricians?
I have perceived an evolution in the statement that comes from ACOG. And it seems to be changing over time, and it's not quite as staunchly oppositional as it was initially. So my recollection of the ACOG committee opinion on home birth was that it used to say basically something like, we support the right of any woman to make an autonomous decision about where she wants to have her baby. However, we believe that the safest place to to give birth is in the hospital. And I will never forget the initial committee opinion cited that the rationale for this was that there's something like a twofold risk of the baby dying in a home birth compared to the hospital birth. Now, when you look at the absolute risk, we've talked about that before, it was a difference of like 4 out of 1,000 versus 2 out of 1,000. And there was zero mention whatsoever about the fact that the C-section rate for moms having a home birth was something in the range of 5%. And moms who are having a hospital birth, it was like 25%. Mm-hmm. So there was a fivefold increase in risk to the mother of having a cesarean delivery. And this was just not even mentioned in the committee opinion. So there was kind of like turning a blind eye.
Which, among other things, means if she's going to have more babies, then her subsequent pregnancies are going to be more risky.
Absolutely.
Than had she not had that cesarean.
So over time, this committee opinion has really been changing. And the most recent one, it's a very interesting read. And I think it's much more balanced. And they do talk about, the risks of interventions in the hospital. And they talk about It's much more nuanced about that the safety of home birth is going to vary depending on a lot of factors, depending on, the skill of the attendant, the inherent characteristics of the mother and whether she has certain high-risk features, the distance of the location of the home birth to the nearest hospital and what's going to be the transport time in the case of emergency. They get into another issue, they sort of touch on it, which is the notion of the integration of the system. So for example, in Europe, there are certain countries where the notion of home birth, it's just built into the system. They have a seamless transport from home to the hospital and sort of accept it. Mm-hmm. And so there's open communication between, the home birth providers and the hospital providers. And it's very seamless, almost like if you're transferring within the hospital from the labor room into the OR because that was needed, you might be transferring from home into the hospital because that is needed. In the United States, it's never been an integrated system. And there, in certain settings, and I'm not saying this is rare, this is probably very common, there's a very strong bias against home birth. So when the transport happens from home birth to the hospital, they're met with a very negative response.
Yes.
And I've even heard of cases where the receiving team doesn't even want to hear the report from the home birth attending. I do not want you to open your mouth. I don't want to hear what you have to say. So there's a complete fracture of the care from one setting to the other. And that's something that makes it incredibly unsafe when you don't have, collaboration from the home birth to the hospital birth.
On many levels.
So that's something that could make a home birth safer if there's better integration from one level to the next. And it makes it more dangerous if the specific setting you're in, you can't count on that. I think the current ACOG committee opinion is much more nuanced. And less, I think, dogmatic and imbalanced compared to some of their older statements. So I think we're sort of seeing before our very eyes an evolution in, the point of view.
And also, home birth, out of hospital birth in general is on the rise. more women are choosing to do it and their partners are choosing to do it. There's more midwives, more birthing centers popping up all over the place. And I also see, I think from the younger crowd of doctors, more of an openness to their clients, you know, their patients who want to do it. Maybe not officially backing up their midwives, but at least open to doing co-care or being available for transport, you know, should they get called, as long as they were not told it was going to be a home birth.
And you just reminded me of another very interesting feature of the ACOG committee opinion on home birth is, so I quoted to you what they used to say, that we believe the safest place to give birth is the hospital. The current statement says, we believe the safest place to give birth is in a hospital or accredited birth center.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Now, that term birth center is very interesting because it's a little bit of a murky term. There's a lot of hospitals that use the term birth center, and you're really referring to a hospital setting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wow.
But they didn't say hospital. They didn't say birth centers within hospitals. They said accredited birth centers. Okay. And there are definitely freestanding
accredited birth centers
that are outside of the hospital. So they've all of a sudden, in their most recent committee opinion, lumped in accredited birth centers as, you know, one of the safest places to give birth.
But that is a more open-minded
statement. I would say so, definitely.
Yeah. Right. So things are kind of changing.
Hey.
Slowly, gradually.
Slowly. I do have this thought based on just working with a lot of people who have to make this choice that I think that some people feel much safer at a hospital for whatever reason. And I think it's probably the best place for them to give birth if that's where they really feel safe and they don't feel safe out of a hospital. And some people feel so much safer out of a hospital and don't feel safe at a hospital. And with those people who don't feel safe in a hospital and choose to have the baby there anyway, I have so many experiences where we're doing amazing at home with labor and then for just magic, we just arrive to the hospital and everything starts to slow down and become more complicated. So I think, you know, ACOG says the safest place to give birth. I think you also have to take into account how somebody feels about the setting that they're in or the providers who they're with. That's my little final thought. Do you guys have any final thoughts?
Absolutely. I think in obstetrics, we very often ask questions that are not interesting. And so in this case, the example of the not interesting question is, which is safer, hospital birth or home birth? It is the boringest question you could possibly ask. Because neither one is ever going to disappear. We're never going to get to a place in society where nobody gives birth at home and we don't have birth centers and that's always going to exist. And we're never going to get to a place where birth moves completely into the home and birth centers and we don't have hospital births. We are always going to have both. So to me, the interesting question is, how do we make hospital birth safer? Because that's certainly a problem in our society that needs to be worked on. There are plenty of risks that a mother and baby faces in a hospital and complications that can happen as a result of her care. So how do we make hospital birth safer? And simultaneously, how do we make home birth safer? Training midwives, integrating home births into the larger maternity care structure and having good seamless communication between, you know, home birth and hospital settings when that needs to happen. So how do we make both of them safer? I think that's the much more interesting question.
When you see that happen, when you're at a home birth with someone who has a really good plan for transfer, should it be necessary, it's so much more comfortable. It takes off so much of the pressure of not having that, you know, and then forcing yourself to stay home even when you don't want to anymore or where you're not sure that you should anymore. So on so many levels, what you're saying, I think, will make both of them more, both safer and also more supported and enjoyable experiences.
Just to chime in on that, my first was at Good Samaritan. At the time, they had the certified nurse midwives there on staff. And I think that, one, made me feel comfortable. And two, I don't know what their numbers are at that time, if they had more C-sections or not, but I think having nurse midwives on staff can definitely help with all of that, as far as, you know, trying to do it naturally and being open-minded to that route instead of always just like, okay, emergency C-section or C-section. I heard that they no longer have them. I'm not sure why or what happened, but I think at the time...
At that particular hospital.
Yeah, at Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. I think at the time it was such a great thing that they had them on staff and they were there, and it was just a part of the birthing experience there. So I don't know if more hospitals would do that or be open to that, because I think that would help.
I think it's a fact.
Absolutely.
That there are births that took place at home that would have ended better at a hospital. And births that took place at a hospital that would have ended better at home. Mm-hmm. My sort of take-home message is that for most people, two very safe options with different pros and cons and different risks and benefits. And like everything else in this genre, you have to do your homework and find out right. what decisions you want to make, what benefits and risks are the ones that you want to take, because ultimately it is your body, it is your baby and your experience, and none of us can make those decisions for you.
Right.
Where can we find you guys online? Oh, great. Janice, you're on Twitter at Janice's, but it's really just Janice S.
Yes.
and on Facebook, Janice Sardoy, and on Instagram, which is my favorite, Janice's Pieces. Because it reminds me of one of my favorite foods. I won't say which one. Dr. Shabir, where can we find you online?
I'm kind of old school about the whole social media thing. So I have a MySpace page.
Do you really?
No,
no, I'm just kidding.
What?
I did make one advance beyond MySpace. I have a Facebook page.
Ooh.
Where I put some little birth stories, and apart from that, mostly links to your podcast.
Oh, amazing. Nice. I highly recommend your page.
Yeah, so it's so it's Emiliano Chavira, MD. MPH, FACOG.
Nice.
And by the time you're done typing that in, you're asleep.
.com.
Well, you have a new follower. I'll do it.
I'm on there. All right. Thanks a lot for being here, you guys. Always an interesting conversation. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, just send us an email at info@informedpregnancy.com.
Give me the news, I got a whole lot of questions for you. This kid's gonna test my will, I got a lot to learn and my baby's due.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash.